Hey guys, welcome back to Making a Dietitian. I am Cassie, and today we will be covering the pathophysiology and medical nutrition therapy for lower gastrointestinal diseases. Sorry I wasn't able to make an episode last week. I was on vacation with my family, but I'm here now, and so for this week to make up for it, I will again be posting two episodes. The next one is probably I know I said I was going to do the bariatric surgery next, but I figured we should probably talk about lower GI first, just to get an idea of conditions having to do with your lower GI, and then we'll talk about bariatric surgery and gastric bypass in the next episode. So this is going to be a much longer and in-depth discussion than upper GI, just because there's a lot more issues at hand here. So we're gonna get started, and then after the bariatric episode, I'm gonna do the pathophys and MNT for accessory organs. So that will also be coming soon. So not all issues in the small intestines are gonna be major issues. So like a lot of people obviously suffer from constipation and diarrhea at some point in their life, and there are chronic forms of these as well, which I personally think sucks. That would suck. So the first issue we're going to talk about would be flatulence. So this is just whenever gas is building up in the intestines due to swallowing air or bacterial fermentation, both of which may be expelled through burping or flatulence. Unfortunately, excessive production of gas may lead patients to feelings of discomfort, such as abdominal distension and cramping in the upper or lower GI tract. So our job as dietitians would be to figure out if the gas is from an overproduction of gas or gas that's just simply not being passed, and then changes in diets that may have affected the body and its production of gas. So specific foods may include dairy products, beans, cruciferous veggies, that's going to be like your broccoli and cauliflower, high-fiber fruits, carbonated beverages and fruit drinks, and foods with sugar alcohols. So those would just be things that we may look for in a 24-hour recall or something like that, and just kind of be like, hey, that's probably why. And then we would also recommend that patients begin to slowly introduce more fiber into their diet to assist with the passage of stool. So next, we're going to talk about constipation. A large number of individuals suffer from constipation, impacting quality of life and healthcare costs, which, as you know, that is something I feel very strongly about. So some risk factors include being female, unfortunately, being elderly, having a high BMI, and a low socioeconomic status. The causes of constipation are very individualized, but low fiber intake is one of the most common reasons. You know, fiber is like amazing, phenomenal. Other causes could include like a low calorie or low fluid intake, iron and calcium supplements. Yeah, if you take iron supplements, which I feel like honestly probably quite a few people do, especially women, yeah, that can like really affect your stool, which sucks. Lack of exercise, because you're not moving, so your organs also aren't moving as much, so you're not passing that stool as often or as fast, and so water is being taken out of them, and it gets hard. Again, immobility, laxative abuse, chronic intestinal pseudo-obstruction, hypothyroidism, colonic inertia, don't ask me what that is, gastroparesis, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, MS, muscular dystrophy, Parkinson's, cerebral palsy, paralysis, spinal cord injury, cerebrovascular disease, brain trauma, pregnancy, those who frequent opiates, diseases of the upper GI tract, diseases of large bowel, IBS, and anal fissures. So there's a lot of reasons why someone may suffer from constipation. So constipation is classified as primary and secondary, and then the primary constipation is then classified as normal transit constipation, where your stool passes through the colon at a rate of about 5 days. So symptoms may include hard stools, bloating, and abdominal pain. Then we have slow transit constipation, causes infrequent bowel movement of less than once per week. Symptoms may include bloating and abdominal pain due to decreased water content in the stool and reduced propulsive action. And last, we have anorectal dysfunction, and this results from the pelvic floor muscle laxity, impaired rectal sensation, and decreased luminal pressure in the anal canal. Oh my gosh. Treatment includes biofeedback therapy to retrain the muscles. MNT includes increasing both soluble and insoluble fiber as well as fluid. And then this is because fiber is going to increase the mass of stool, the stool weight, and the frequency and the colonic transit. So the recommended daily allowance for fiber is about 25 grams for females and 38 grams for males. Obviously, if you consume more than that, it's usually okay. I think there are cases where it's not, but most of the time, you're not gonna get told not like to consume less fiber unless you are like a special case and you do have something going on with your stomach or intestines where you should not be consuming as much fiber. And I'm pretty sure we cover that. Maybe we did cover that. To be honest, I went on vacation and I forgot everything. So, diarrhea is next. This is going to be defined as the passage of three or more loose stools per day. There's many reasons for an individual to have diarrhea, including inflammatory disease, infection with fungal, bacterial, or viral agents, medications, overconsumption of sugars or other osmotic substances, an allergic response to food, or insufficient or damaged mucosal absorptive surfaces. Also, quite a bit of a list there. In short, diarrhea often leads to malabsorption of many foods. Because of this, a person is likely to suffer from some form of deficiency as a secondary to malabsorption. Hopefully that made sense, because reading that, I feel like my brain just shut off. Yes. Okay, so to treat diarrhea, we really have to identify the cause. It's not going to be like a treat the symptom type of thing. You just have to find the cause. An individual should be increasing their fluid and electrolyte intake with oral glucose electrolyte solutions with added potassium, because you are losing so much in your stool. You're not absorbing any of that fluid or any of those nutrients. It's just going right through you. So your body's like, I don't have anything. And then in a like, so there's diarrhea, and then there's diarrhea that's secondary to C. diff. It has a longer name than that, but that's all I've ever called it, and that's what everyone knows it as. So this is going to be a spore-forming organism, and it really sucks because the patient has to be treated typically with a fecal microbial transplant. This is when a healthy stool sample is taken, likely from a family member or someone who's going to have like the same kind of diet. And that stool sample is placed into the infection or infected patient's colon, so that their bacteria can grow back healthy, because all the bacteria in their gut is like ruined. It sounds disgusting. And to be honest, I would not be happy about it, but I hear it's very effective. So, you know, you can't win them all. Sometimes you just gotta do it. So, C. diff is very infectious, and once an individual has it, they're at an increased risk for becoming infected again. And because of this, the hospitals usually have very, very strict protocol whenever there is a case of C. diff, because it is so easily transmitted. Overall, it leads to seriously, seriously foul-smelling diarrhea, to be honest. I have been so lucky, and as many times as I've worked in a nursing home, never had to be in a room with a patient who's suffering from C. diff, but I know that it is just, like, tragic. So, but overall, in terms of treating diarrhea in general, medical nutrition therapy is going to include treating the underlying conditions. So a lot of times someone who's consuming sugar alcohols or lactose, fructose, or large amounts of sucrose, it could worsen the osmotic diarrheas. And then fibrous materials tend to slow gastric emptying and then moderate overall GI transit and pull water into the intestinal lumen. So fiber should be provided to increase the volume of stool. So if you see a pattern so far, it's that fiber is absolutely amazing, and you should do all that you can to incorporate it into your diet. It's really not that hard. You can get, like, really high fibers, fruits and veggies, your whole grains. A lot of times you're gonna be high in fiber. There you have a lot of options. It's good for you. So next, we're going to hit gastrointestinal strictures and obstructions, such as gastroparesis, adhesions, hernias, metastatic cancers, dysmotility, or volvulus are prone to obstructions. Sorry, I feel like I'm butchering this. I feel like my mind is just somewhere else right now. So obviously obstructions are awful and can lead to very serious complications. As for MNT, honestly, there's not a whole lot we can do for an obstruction. A lot of times it's going to have to be dealt with surgery, but we can help to kind of minimize the effects of that. So if there's a partial blockage, a fiber-restricted diet may be tolerated. And that's where you're going to hit, like, oh, you need to consume less fiber, because you don't want something to get stuck and create a total blockage. But also, even if the partial blockage is there, someone could require a liquid diet if it's severe enough. And then for a total obstruction, enteral feeding may be required. And then if enteral feeding is not an option for a long period of time, parenteral feeding may be needed. I will eventually cover a more in-depth episode of enteral and parenteral feeding later on. I'm just kind of going in some sort of an order, like something you might see in class. I don't think we ever hit on enteral and parenteral feeding until probably the end of MNT2. So there's definitely some time. So now I'm going to go into more specific diseases. I'm first going to start with celiac disease, and this is a small intestine disorder that's going to leave patients sensitive to gluten. So basically what happens is the peptides in gluten travel across the intestinal lumen, across the intestinal epithelium, and into the lamina propria. I'm so sorry if I'm butchering these. Where the inflammatory response is triggered. Someone who doesn't have celiac disease, obviously an inflammatory response isn't going to be triggered here. But if you do suffer from that, you do have that inflammatory response. And so over time, this inflammation is going to lead to the degradation of the intestinal villi. So the intestines basically flatten, and that's going to lead to less absorption, because normally your intestines are like, have all these little tiny protrusions and fingers and everything that increase the surface area, so you can absorb a lot more, nutrients and everything. But if it flattens, you're not absorbing, hardly anything, and food is pretty much just like passing right through you, because there's nothing there to suck in that nutrients. So you're likely also going to have some form of deficiency if that happens for long enough. So there is gluten sensitivity, and this is when an individual has a non-specific symptoms. And then there's gluten intolerance, and this is when an individual has symptoms such as nausea, abdominal pain, and diarrhea after the ingestion of gluten. And then there's celiac disease, when the body produces an immune response to gluten, leading to intestinal damage that may later cause issues in secretion, digestion, and absorption. So there are different levels of gluten sensitivity. Obviously, celiac disease is the most severe of that. So yeah, just keep that in mind. Just because you have a gluten sensitivity does not mean you have a celiac disease. So over time, all of these issues can cause impaired nutrient, macronutrient, and micronutrient absorption. So in terms of medical nutrition therapy, we are going to recommend a diet that eliminates gluten peptides from the diet. So you are going to eliminate wheat, rye, and barley, which you can imagine makes up a lot of food options. So foods that can be consumed are going to include potatoes, rice, crackers, chips, popcorn, milk and yogurts, cheese, eggs, meats, fish, legumes, beans, soy products, nuts and seeds, fruits and juices, veggies, and then acceptable grains are going to include amaranth, arrowroot, bean flours, cornstarch, flax, quinoa, tapioca, and oats that are uncontaminated, because a lot of times your oats are going to be processed in the same place that you have wheat, rye, and barley, so you do have to make sure that there's no risk of cross-contamination there. So once an individual begins a gluten-free diet, the intestinal lining should begin healing, leading to increased absorption. Partial supplementation may be necessary due to the fact that a lot of your gluten-free options aren't going to be fortified with B vitamins like a lot of our options are. Because if we go back to the micronutrient episode, I talk about how a lot of our wheat products and grain products are fortified with B vitamins. So honestly, living with celiac disease is very difficult, especially here in America. A lot of our foods are made with gluten, so an individual really has to be wary and read nutrition labels thoroughly and really scrutinize menus when eating out. I do believe a lot of places have gotten better about labeling their menu items as gluten-free and offering more options, but you also have to be concerned about cross-contamination. So places such as like buffets, probably not the best idea, but like reputable places and restaurants, you can talk to servers, you can talk to cooks. You just really want to make sure you're not putting yourself at risk. I remember I think we did an assignment concerning celiac disease, and if it goes on long enough, it can have some very severe effects on the body, and you just really don't want to suffer from that. I really think if it goes on long enough, it can lead to infertility and like very severe consequences. So if you are someone who is suffering from celiac disease, I really recommend that you take care of yourself and just do your best to educate yourself on what is best for your diet. So next, we're going to talk about lactose intolerance. This is something that a lot of people suffer from. And there's a huge reason for that. So lactose intolerance is characterized by diarrhea, abdominal cramping, flatulence, or bloating after consuming lactose, which is found in dairy products such as milk, cheese, and creams. Lactose intolerance may occur for numerous reasons, including infection of the small intestine, inflammatory disorders, HIV, or malnutrition. So, lactose intolerance occurs in many specific populations due to the fact that once we wean off of breast milk, the small intestines decreases the production of the enzyme lactase. And if you use your context clues, lactase is an enzyme that breaks down lactose. You know, crazy how that works. So specific populations, including those who are Asian, African, Latino, and Native American, are going to have this decreased production of lactase, while those who are Caucasian typically still produce an ample amount of lactase. If an individual is lactose intolerant, when they consume lactose, they will have loose stools because the malabsorbed sugars cause water to increase in the intestines and also offer sustenance for intestinal bacteria, leading to the bloating and cramping, which is why you feel horrible. You can take supplements such as Lactaid, and those are going to offer lactase enzymes into the diet. But really, as a dietitian, we're going to suggest that you reduce your consumption of lactose-containing foods. And because most lactose-containing foods are dairy products, you should probably be supplementing with calcium and vitamin D once you do cut those out of your diet. So yeah, now you know why people suffer from lactose intolerance. So, kind of going off of lactose intolerance, a lesser known condition is going to be fructose malabsorption. This is another sugar. So dietary fructose may be monosaccharides, sucrose, or a chain of fructans. And fructose may sound familiar, as in fruit or fruit juices and drinks, as well as high fructose corn syrup in soft drinks and sweets. So we have a limited ability to absorb fructose, and fructose malabsorption is common in healthy people. So fructose should be consumed with glucose to assist absorption. As far as medical nutrition therapy for fructose malabsorption, it's going to include limiting consumption of high fructose containing foods such as pears, apples, mangoes, Asian pears, as well as dried fruits, fruit juices, and foods with high fructose corn syrup. If you have looked at a nutrition label in the past 5 years, you may have noticed that almost everything contains some form of high fructose corn syrup. So, that really sucks. Honestly. Really, really sucks. Okay, so now I'm going to cover inflammatory bowel disease, which is different than irritable bowel syndrome. Just keep that in mind. So there are two main ones, and this is going to be Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. These are typically going to affect individuals in northern climates and those who live in urban areas. So clinical characteristics of both are going to include diarrhea, fever, weight loss, anemia, food intolerances, malnutrition, growth failure, and extra intestinal manifestations. So malignancy also increases with the duration of the disease. The cause is not well understood, but it includes the GI immunological system and genetics and environmental factors. So Crohn's disease could affect any part of the GI tract, but most often affects the distal ileum and the colon, while ulcerative colitis affects strictly just the colon and rectum. So, it's as far as like the pathophysiology goes, there's really all these things, you know, the genetic predisposition, the unknown irritant, whether that's viral, bacterial, autoimmune, we don't really know. Also, vitamin D deficiency. All of those are going to lead to abnormal activation in the mucosal immune response. And so this is going to lead to, obviously, inflammation, which is later going to lead to damage to the cells of the small and or large intestine with malabsorption, ulceration, and stricture. And then that, in turn, is going to lead to diarrhea, weight loss, poor growth, hyperhomocysteinemia, and partial GI obstructions. Kind of a lot. So as far, there are obviously medical managements of this, you know, corticosteroids, which if you take long enough, could lead to glucose issues. You have anti-inflammatory agents, immunosuppressants, antibiotics, and anti-cytokine medications. Also, you could have surgical management, which is going to include bowel resection. And this can result in short bowel syndrome, which is a whole other thing. But since we're focused on the nutritional management of this, really, if it gets bad enough, you know, it's kind of on and off. So during periods where it is flaring up, there may be times whenever oral enteral nutrition or formula is needed, so tube feeding. Obviously, you want to be consuming foods that are well tolerated. Parenteral nutrition in patients with severe diseases or obstructions may be necessary. We really do want to be recommending supplementation of folic acid, B12, and B6. We also want to supplement omega-3 fatty acids. And then we want to consider the use of prebiotics and probiotics. Also, we might need to modify fiber intake and test for food intolerances. So all of those things are really kind of going to be up there. Honestly, the medical nutrition therapy is very long and very extensive. And there are going to be a lot of fears and misconceptions that are going to come with food for someone who has inflammatory bowel disease. So there's going to be so many things that come at patients, and really anyone suffering from any type of GI disorder, where you have like family friends who are telling you this, and the media is who's telling you this, and doctors who are telling you this. And it's so hard for patients to feel confident in what they're hearing, because a lot of times those are going to fail and they're going to say, nothing's working for me. Why should I trust what a dietitian is telling me? Because nothing's working. So in short, there's really no single dietary regimen for reducing symptoms or decreasing the flares. So diet and specific nutrients are going to play a supportive role in maintaining nutritional status, limiting symptoms, and supporting growth in pediatric patients. But there isn't going to be a one single cut out this and you're good, or eat this and you're good. That's just not how it works. That's never been how it works. But really, when there is a flare-up, we do recommend bowel rest because we don't want to make anything worse. So that's where your enteral or parenteral feeding is going to come in. So yeah, there are some small flares that may happen over time. This could be characterized by partial obstructions, nausea, abdominal pain, bloating, or diarrhea. You do have those individual food intolerances that may cause these as well, but really, it's not something that we have the tools to fix necessarily. It's just more of like treating the symptoms that come up, and that's really unfortunate. So it's so individualized, so it's hard for me to sit here and like give you a specific medical nutrition therapy advice besides the supplementation and besides the, oh, you may need enteral or parenteral feeding. Like, it's kind of hard for us to say that whenever it is so specific to each patient. So I'm not going to sit here and waste your time listening to the, oh, you might need this, oh, you might need that, and that's just not how it works. So then I'm going to move on to irritable bowel syndrome. Obviously, like I said, these are two completely different things, despite the fact that they almost have the exact same acronym. So IBS is characterized by unexplained abdominal discomfort or pain that's associated with changes in bowel habits. Other symptoms may include gas, bloating, diarrhea, and constipation, increased GI distress associated with psychosocial distress. So in short, IBS, not a specific marker test to tell you you have IBS. It's really just kind of like a umbrella term or like a catch-all for things that aren't specific, other specific diseases. And that being said, it's obviously not well understood. So it's presumed that a number of factors are going to play a role in the formation of IBS. So you may have nervous system alterations, which are going to include abnormal GI motility and visceral hypersensitivity, your gut flora alterations, genetics, and psychosocial stress. Really, like I said, it's a catch-all. So what are you going to do about it? As far as medical nutrition therapy goes, because it is also so individualized, like IBD, IBS is really up to the patient on how they want to treat that and what works best for them. So things that we're going to do as a dietitian is going to be like going over medications to see if there's a possible like nutrient drug interaction going on. And then we're going to review the GI symptoms. We're going to assess nutritional status and food intake, and then we will review the supplementation intake. So all of those things together is kind of what we're going to do to kind of look back through and say, oh, maybe this is causing this. Maybe that's why. And that's how we're going to get to kind of our nutrient intervention, because it is going to be individualized. So what we are really going to do is we're going to take FODMAPs and make an eating plan with FODMAPs. And I don't know if you've ever heard of this. I had heard of it, but I was also like, I don't know what the heck that is. It stands for stuff. It's an acronym, as weird as that sounds. So a FODMAP diet is basically limiting things that are shown in a vast population of people to have like a negative effect on the bowel. A FODMAP diet, a low FODMAP diet. So FODMAPs is the bad things, and you want a low FODMAP diet, basically. So F is going to be fructose, lactose, galactans, sure, alcohols. I'm pretty positive that FODMAPs stands for something, and I'm gonna give you that meaning because this book is not telling me what I want to know. It's not giving me like a specific thing, but I know it exists, so why am I just having issues with this? Okay. Yeah. Okay. So FODMAPs stands for fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, and monosaccharides, and polys. Okay. So in short, it's really going to be your sugar, starches, and fibers in foods. And then eating too much of them is probably going to cause issues. So foods like fruits, honeys, high fructose corn syrups, agave, dairy, wheat, onions, garlic, legumes, beans, lentils, soybeans, and then your sugar, alcohols, and fruits with pits or seeds. All of those things are what is going to go into a FODMAP diet. So we recommend that you have a low FODMAP diet. There's not like an acceptable way to define low. It really is, again, individualized. I'm sure you're absolutely tired of hearing me say that. I'm kind of tired of hearing me say that, but it's true. You just want to cut out basically all of these things, and then you can slowly start adding them back one at a time, probably like one food every week-ish. And that way, as you're slowly adding these back, if you don't have any reactions, you're good. You can continue to eat that food. But if you have a reaction, obviously, then you know which food is going to be affecting your diet and which foods you should cut out completely. So it's not necessarily like you need to follow this specific diet forever. It's more of like, hey, slowly add these things back and figure out which one is causing you issues or which ones. And that's kind of where you go from there. At least that way, unless you are having a reaction to all of them, you can typically kind of bring those back in, and it's kind of better. Okay, so I'm going to move on to diverticular diseases. This is super common. It's characterized by the formation of sac-like pouches or pockets within the colon, and these are going to form when the colonic mucosa and submucosa herniate through weakened areas of muscle. And then, so like diverticulitis is whenever there's complications of the diverticulosis, and this is indicated by inflammation, causing flare-ups. Obviously not good. It's really unfortunate because this really doesn't have a great etiology. So that kind of sucks. But it has been implicated that a low-fiber diet could be a reason for the development of diverticular disease. This is because low-fiber diets are going to reduce the stool volume, predisposing individuals to constipation and increasing intracolonic pressure, suggesting that diverticulosis occurs as a consequence of pressure-induced damage to the colon. So what did we learn, everybody? Fiber is super important so you don't develop diverticular disease. So the pathophysiology of this, it's really just going to be that diverticulosis and diverticulitis suggest chronic inflammation, alterations in colonic microbiota. Okay. Disturbed colonic sensorimotor functions and abnormal colon motility have likely interrelated roles in the development of diverticular disease. Sorry, that was so hard for me to get out. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's just that I have poor lighting, but it's also probably the fact that I can't spell, so why should I be able to read? So as far as the medical nutrition therapy goes, we recommend the avoidance of nuts, seeds, wholes, corn, and popcorn to prevent symptoms or complications of diverticular disease. That's kind of like been the recommendation, but lately a bunch of studies have come out that have been like, there's no correlation literally at all, except for the fact an inverse relationship between nut and popcorn consumption and the risk of diverticulitis was demonstrated, suggesting a protective effect. So maybe you should increase your consumption of nuts and popcorn to prevent and help your diverticulitis. So during an acute episode of diverticulitis or diverticular bleeding, oral intake is generally reduced until your symptoms subside. So in this case, we are suggesting bowel rest. And so then because of that, we would probably recommend parenteral nutrition support. And then once oral intake has been resumed, you're going to begin a low fiber diet because you don't want to put a whole lot of stress on your colon. There's not really any convincing evidence that high fiber diets can reverse the pathophysiology of diverticular disease. But there is reasonable evidence that this type of diet can improve diverticular symptoms. So a high fiber diet in combination with adequate hydration promotes soft, bulky stools that pass more swiftly and require less straining with defecation. So again, your recommended dietary intakes are still going to be the same as what I said earlier, 25 grams per day for women and 38 grams per day for men. But if you are suffering from an episode or a flare-up of diverticulitis, you really should decrease your fiber intake and then slowly increase it because you don't want to cause bloating or gas. You just don't want to cause anything that's going to lead to even more discomfort than you already have. So next, I'm sorry, this chapter is like so freaking long. I'm kind of going to like speed through it because these aren't things that we in particular went through a whole lot in depth with. So I don't have like the classroom education of this, and I'm really just using the resources that I have in terms of textbooks. So I don't really want to sit here and just like read from a textbook. I feel like that would be a waste of your time whenever you could probably look it up on your own. So I am going to make this kind of a short little thing with the next few topics. So now we have small bowel resection and short bowel syndrome. So short bowel syndrome is really defined as an inadequate absorptive capacity resulting from reduced length or decreased functional bowel after resection. Basically meaning that your bowel was cut and they had to resect it, making it smaller, and that led to less ability for your body to absorb things because there's not very much left in terms of length for you to absorb things. Reasons that you may have a bowel resection are that include Crohn's disease, radiation enteritis, mesenteric infarction, malignant disease, and some other things. So there's different types of resections. You can have a duodenal resection, jejunal resection, and ileal resection. Those are all just different parts where it's going to be resected in your small intestine. And that is going to have different effects. So in a duodenal resection, it's rare, which is fortunate because it is the preferred site for absorption of key nutrients such as iron, zinc, copper, and folate. And the duodenum is a key player in the digestion and absorption of nutrients because it is the portal entry for pancreatic enzymes. And we haven't talked about the pancreas here, but basically it is like the most amazing organ in your whole body. So we really need that. And so you really don't want to have a duodenal resection. And then you have a jejunal resection, and this is the next part of your intestine. Normally most digestion and absorption of food and nutrient occurs in the first 100 centimeters of the small intestine, which is going to include the duodenum. Really here, I don't know if it's the most common, but just it happens. I feel like I didn't say anything about that. Sorry. Okay. So jejunal enteral hormones play key roles in digestion and absorption. You have CCK stimulates pancreatic secretion and gallbladder contractions, and secretin stimulates secretion of bicarbonate from the pancreas. So basically you're going to have a lot of digestion here. So you really probably, I mean, you really don't have a bowel resection anywhere. That kind of sucks, but here would also suck. Okay, sorry about that. I have sisters. So lastly, we have an ileal resection. This is really going to cause a lot of issues in terms of nutrition and medication, or medical complications. So this is the only site for absorption of bile salts and vitamin B12 intrinsic factor complex. So the ileum also absorbs a major portion of the 7 to 10 liters of fluid ingested and secreted into the GI tract daily. So yeah, it's really going to suck. And although malabsorption of bile salts may appear to be benign, it creates a cascade of consequences. So if the ileum cannot recycle the bile salts secreted into the GI tract, the hepatic production cannot maintain a sufficient bile salt pool because it reuses it. So then it can't emulsify lipids. And if you can't emulsify lipids, it's just a really unfortunate thing because then pretty sure you like build up. You like keep absorbing a lot of fats, like you're not secreting them as much as you should be. Also, there's going to be a malabsorption of fat soluble vitamins. Oh yeah, it's a malabsorption of fat and fat soluble vitamins such as A, D, E, and K. And a malabsorption of fatty acids can result in their combination with calcium, zinc, and magnesium to form fatty acid mineral soaps, thus leading to their malabsorption as well. So basically resections are just shitty no matter what. We do have a colon resection as well. It's really just not good. So preservation of the colon is key to maintaining your hydration status. And however, if the patient has any colon left, malabsorption of bile salts can act as a mucosal irritant, increasing colonic motility with fluid and electrolyte losses. Consumption of high-fat diets with ileal resection and retained colon may also result in the formation of hydroxy fatty acids, which also increase fluid loss. As we know, fluid loss is not good for you. So medical nutrition therapy for patients who have significant bowel resections require parenteral nutrition initially to restore and maintain nutritional status. So bowel rest, obviously, if you have surgery on your bowel, you're going to need bowel rest. It's kind of how that works. You can't just go into straight eating. Obviously, it's going to be individualized, of course, because it's going to depend on where you have your resection and how healthy the patient is and the condition of the remaining GI tract. In more extreme and severe cases, the slower the progression to a normal diet, it's like the more severe it is, the slower it is. I feel like my tone of voice did not convey that that was a whole sentence. Small frequent meals, so 6 to 10 meals per day, are likely to be better tolerated. Tube feeding may be useful to maximize intake when a patient would not typically eat. So if you can't seem to eat as much during the day, you may want to hook up some enteral feeding for the night, just to increase your calories, because since you are going to be recovering from a surgery, you do have increased calorie and protein needs, so you may not be getting that just from eating. It really could take up to 1 to 2 years after surgery for the GI tract to be fully healed. You're going to have adaptations to improve function, but it's not always going to lead to how it was before. So you just really have to be aware of that. I'm not going to talk about overgrowth. A fistula, this is an abnormal passage of an organ to another organ. I remember I have one of my friends in the class, she was just like absolutely astonished by fistulas, like, just, and I mean, I can't blame her, because they make absolutely no sense to me. Why does your body just think that we should connect random organs to each other? Like, absolutely doesn't make any sense. I think the most common ones are going to be between the small and large intestines. So really, medical nutrition therapy for this is going to be very challenging, because where is it going? What's happening? Why is this happening? So a lot of times we're going to have patients on nothing by mouth, which is NPO, as the fistula outfit is quantified and measured. Nutritional support during this inertial workup phase, parenteral nutrition, tube feeding, oral diet, or a combination of all of those or any of those is used in patients with those fistulas. The decision regarding which route to feed patients with depends on several factors, including the origin of the fistula, the presence of obstruction or abscesses, the length of the functional bowel, and the likelihood of the fistula closure, the ability to manage fistula output, and the patient's overall medical condition. So yeah. Next we have a colostomy. A colostomy is a surgically created opening from the colon to the skin where a portion of the large intestine is removed or bypassed. So you have like a bag next to your stomach where you're going to have an output instead of it going down to the rectum and then being excreted. Honestly, I don't think it's that uncommon to have a colostomy. And then an ileostomy is going to be obviously what it sounds like, where a surgically created opening from the distal small bowel to the skin where the entire colon, rectum, and anus are removed or bypassed. So instead of having something that would be coming out of the colon, where it's typically going to be more solid because you do have time to reabsorb that water. In an ileostomy, the bag is right after or right during the ileum, and so a lot of times that whatever is produced is going to be very watery because that water wasn't reabsorbed. In terms of medical nutrition therapy, we're going to hold feeding until the bowel has started some form of function. It really, there's like a lot. It's really going to depend on specifically what is going on and what you're doing. We went pretty in depth in colostomies and ileostomies, and I honestly feel like me talking about it now is going to be like a disservice because I can't go that in depth for it. Really, I mean, there's like foods that are going to cause different things. So like foods that may cause diarrhea, alcoholic beverages, caffeinated foods, chocolates, whole grains, fresh fruits, grape juice, prune juice, raw vegetables. And then you have foods that may cause an obstruction. So apple peel, orange, pineapple, honestly, a lot of fruits, corn, mushroom, coconut, popcorn, nuts. Odor producing foods are going to be asparagus, beans, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, fish, onions. So there's a lot that goes into ostomies, and I feel like I am not qualified at this point to talk about them, so I don't really want to sit here and waste your time. But that's kind of the end of the lower GI tract disorders. I feel like I was kind of all over the place. That's totally my bad. Still getting back from vacation is kind of like, you know, it's got me a little out of it. But I am really excited for the gastric bypass and bariatric surgery episode. So be looking for that coming out later this week. I promise it will be a lot more put together than this was. Hopefully you still learned something and got a little introduction into things. Yeah, I hope you have a great day.